office.
Yeah, they're clearly hearing the heat. So the question, as Nancy Pelosi said, is will they reverse the things that have happened, not just stop doing it? Stopping it, we've already seen the damage done. The question is a true reversal to the status quo before Lou DeJoy became the Postmaster General this summer.
Lisa Graves, we want to thank you so much for being with us. And we have to stop saying November is the election, because people who vote by mail are voting in the next weeks, and that goes on for more than a month. Lisa Graves, executive director of the policy research group True North, with a new report we'll link to, The Billionaire Behind Efforts to Kill the U.S. Postal Service. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And at KBOO Portland, it is 8 a.m. It's Wednesday morning. Here we go with Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Keep it locked on your community connection, KBOO Portland.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes. Lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now, and you will see we're only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your late with life and hope.
Oh, carry it on.
We're saying,
oh, carry it on.
Keep playing.
And good morning, everybody out there in radio land or computer land or however you're listening to this. I am Paul Rowland. I'll be with you for the next hour till 9 a.m. Get your calls in early, 503-231-8187. That's the number. Yes, we started out, I guess that's become my de facto theme song for the time being, Carry It On by Buffy St. Marie from her album of a few years back called Medicine Songs. Music can be good medicine. We certainly need it in these times. Is there any particular music that you are listening to that you find inspiring that helps you carry it on? That's one thing we could talk about. Bunch of things I'd like to touch on. Got a number of articles queued up. If I haven't frozen my computer with too many articles on the menu bar. But anyway, there's one thing I've been sort of wanting to touch on. I don't know, I kind of back off often when it gets time to do the show because it just seems so personal. But I'm sure many of you, like me, are feeling added stresses. It may be impacting your sleep. Ever since I had a psychic disturbance about 10 years ago, my sleep has been very different than what it used to be. Much more, I wake up a lot more often during the night. It used to be harder to get back to sleep, but I've devised various strategies, found various strategies, and one that I just might be helpful, so I'll just throw it out there. You might have your own ideas you might want to talk about. So anyway, there's a deep circular breathing. If you're not familiar with it, I would really encourage you. When we get stressed out, I mean, you know, a lot of people meditate. I do that. It's a good thing. It's a kind of a quiet breathing. This is a much more intense, focused, deep, and circular breathing. You become like a wave. It's a very interesting experience. I don't want to, proselytize, but I just find it very helpful. It's connected to something called holotropic breathwork, which is one very specific sort of technique. There's many out there. Rebirthing breathing. They're all kind of similar in ways and maybe different in others. Anyway, so you get into this really deep and kind of it can speed up as you go, and it kind of helps you break through whatever it is you're kind of locked into. It may not work for you. I find that usually within half an hour I'm back asleep, and it gets me asleep for several hours. So anyway, if that's helpful to people, then good. If not, then don't use it. But if anybody who has had experience with that, be glad to talk to you about that, hear what your experience has been. Okay, so there is one thing. Oh, I wanted an addendum to last week's show with Jacqueline Keeler. We're talking about Kamala Harris and her record on relating to policies regarding Native Americans in California, where she actively fought legally against some attempts to add relatively small amounts of land into what is known as trust, which is federally held land that's then for the use and occupancy of by Native Americans. And so that was something that's rankled some Native Americans who are who paid attention to that. So, but apparently she also did promise that she would add 500,000 acres to Native American trust land. That was when she was running for president, if she became president. So it's a more complex story. I just wanted to add that note. Okay, so something happened in Southeast Portland yesterday, very distressing. A man wielding a baseball bat burst into several Southeast Portland businesses, ripped down Black Lives Matter signs, and menaced employees and patrons alike, police, owners, and the suspect told the Oregonian. Police arrested Eric Michael Potratz, 36, in one of the Monday attacks. Oh, this is from the Oregonian, Oregon Live, article by Shane Dixon Cavanaugh. Just want to give credit where credit's due. Police arrested him in one of the Monday attacks and said he had been fuming over videos that showed a man being beaten unconscious near a Black Lives Matter rally in Portland the night before. Now, I'm not sure, how deeply we want to wade into this, how much meaning it has in the bigger scheme of things, but it does indicate the danger that this moment of time in which we are living presents. The Boogaloo people infiltrating Black Lives Matter rallies and causing mayhem, people facing off in many different cities, including Portland, gunshots being fired, people being driven into by vehicles. It's kind of nutty and getting nuttier and more dangerous. So, was there a direct connection? Is there anything anybody could have done about? I mean, that did really piss me off too. That person who's now got a name. I don't actually remember it. It's not that important right now. I think important that he be brought to some form of justice personally. Whether he was I'm talking about the man who, as we saw in the video, just brutally kicked the man who was lying defenseless on the ground. And so, I mean, what's the meaning of this? Is it connected to the idea that, you know, we have to contain violence at these rallies and protests, that we have to police them, that, you know, that there's who knows who this person was. I think it needs to come out. I think there's no possible justification for such an action. It was unclear what the person was even doing there. Did the person, you know, it's a form of vigilante justice without even any form of process of coming to, you know, a group decision about carrying out vigilante. It's a lone act by someone who thought he, you know, who knows? I won't even speculate. Okay, so is there a direct line between that and the reaction? Can we say that, you know, we have to stop that sort of thing from happening so that it doesn't inspire other people to carry it? I don't know. It's really, things happen and, you know, things go viral and people react. But I think it is an indication that people really do need to be, people need to be responsible for their actions, because we are living in a media saturated, increasingly because of smartphones, situation where any individual action can have great multiplied effects because of its replication on social media. So, you know, yes, we do have to, in some sense, not police ourselves, but we have to think about what we're doing. You know, so was that person actually a Black Lives Matter protester? Was he just someone who happened to be there? Was he someone who's a protester but having a really, 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 really bad day and just took out his frustrations on this person? Did he have a legitimate reason? If you have information, that, I think that's important to come out. I think it's too early for us to know. Anyway, so, you know, that's an area I know well, Southeast 23rd, that strip between 20th and 28th. I frequent some of those places just up the road from KBOO Radio. It hits close to home. I take the bus down that road all the time. So here's a quote. He walked in with a bat, took down a sign, and yelled at some people. This is a police spokesman, Officer Derek Carmen. He was upset about the man who was attacked downtown by who he believes were BLM protesters. In an interview Tuesday, Potratz confirmed that he had become enraged after watching footage of people pushing, punching, and kicking a man to the ground after he crashed a truck near a demonstration. Okay, so, yeah, he said, it just triggered something inside me. So, yeah, people can be triggered by all sorts of things. You know, obviously he was in a place where he was prone to be triggered, and he was prone to act out in certain ways. You know, we all saw that video, and he's the only one who went out and took it out on, you know, people minding their own business, frequenting, you know, businesses on Southeast Burnside. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say about that. We can just shut that down so I can go on to some other articles. If anybody wants to weigh in on that, I'm happy to hear it. 503-231-8187. I should probably go to my Facebook page and see if anybody's already looking to be on. I seems like I'm not on there anymore, so maybe Sonia, you can break in.
We have James, actually.
What's that?
James is online. Go ahead.
Okay. Before James, I just wanted this one thing I kind of wanted to just get out of the way. It's a quick thing. So, yeah, there's a Democratic National Convention going on. There's a lot to talk about that. A lot of people have wanted to talk about that, talk about the whole issue of, you know, sort of holding our noses and voting for Biden. That seems to be one kind of an extreme way of putting it. And then come November 3rd, we'll challenge the Democratic Party and be in the streets and hold them accountable. But apparently they're doing things like removing from the platform the plank that would have called for ending fossil fuel subsidies. which is a major, should be a key component to any strategy for, you know, dealing with the climate crisis we're in. And then they're having all these people who, whatever, I mean, fine, they're having Republicans, but, you know, Colin Powell, the good soldier who helped cover up the My Lai massacre and lied to get us into the Iraq War, sermonizing on values. Instead, in this time of reckoning, he had the opportunity to come clean, to speak openly about, you know, I mean, it was a Republican administration. So what does the Democrats have to lose to have him talk about that? So anyway, that really galled me, and along with many other things. But we got someone online, James. What are you thinking about these days?
Well, you know, you had just spoken about that brother who went and attacked that transgender woman, and you know, he's getting locked up for attempted murder, I guess. Well, so apparently a lot of the BLM trying to time to Antifa and BLM is coming from a lot of the right wing sites. One of the most prominent ones I read was Nationalist Review, where they're really trying hard to link him to the movement, but then what other people who were actually at the protest said that he's just some jerk, you know, who just, you know, because I mean, obviously, even in this moment, still people, if people can still find time to be racist, they can still find time to be homophobic. So, you know, he obviously wanted to take it out on this lady, but the big thing is that you know, they're trying to tie him to it, and it's not anything new. I mean, especially when you consider the type of vigilante violence we're seeing. You know, I have a friend of mine who, you know, who grew up in the South, you know, at the during segregation, and he used to tell me stories about how when a black person would do something, everybody would go inside and stay inside for a week, because there was always somebody out there looking to get retribution. And that's what this is about. You know, we're, like you said, we're in a historic moment, and we're at a point of reckoning on the brink of a true American revolution, not the colonial war fought in 1776, a true American revolution. And, you know, there's people whose cognitive dissonance about what this country stands for and what it means to them is coming to head with the reality of the situation. I mean,
so
really,
yeah. But let's get back to the situation. I mean, okay, so things like that happen so fast that maybe there's no time to react. But are people ready, you know, to stop something like that from happening? You know,
honestly,
there was a lot of other people around there at the time, right?
Well, I mean, honestly, like I don't really. I mean, it can only be said that, you know, I mean, I don't know if. I mean, I would hope that there'd be people who are there to stop it, but the truth of the matter is that we don't need, I mean, I don't, what I will say is that, you know, situations like this are necessary for the establishment, number one, because it's used to discredit the movement. I mean, they'll use these anecdotal incidents of violence within a mostly peaceful movement to discredit it, but then they won't use the same logic for holding police accountable.
Right, that's, you know, totally
so
true. That's totally true. There
so
is
there's
a,
that.
It's
but
hard.
Then
it's hard
also,
to keep focused on the major narrative going on, and it is easy to get distracted by smaller threads in the narrative. That's true.
My whole thing is like, I'm not discounting what happened. I mean, obviously, we don't want to incite violence against other marginalized communities to lift up other marginalized communities. That doesn't help anybody. But at the same time, understanding that, it is a tactic, and that as long, you know, it's like nobody covered the violence at the Armed Michigan protests. You know, it was hardly covered, the amount of violence the protesters were inciting against police. I mean, getting in their face with no masks on, hollering at them. I mean, there were whole scuffles. I mean, it just, that was not covered during the Armed Michigan protest, which was mostly white, which, you know, in theory, upholds the establishment, because they're not there really protesting rights for everybody. They're just, they're uncomfortable with wearing masks. They feel like, you know, their right of conquest is being denied, so they want to protest that, quote unquote. But that upholds the establishment. These BLM, you know, protests, you know, they're standing up against it. They're running against the grain, and it's not something new. I mean, it's, I don't know. I guess it's just, you know, it's America has a short memory. You know, because we've gone, as Chris Hedges would put it, from a age of literacy to an age of spectacle and, you know, illusion. You know, our memories are short. So the idea that we can have this memory of, you know, almost 100 years ago of, you know, police going to protests where people are trying to get better wages and better working conditions, and having police come out beat and tear gas people because they want something better, is not something that's readily available in people's memories. People think we've always had an 8-hour work day, or that we've always been paid a wage that was, you know, granted it's not really a living wage, but at least, you know, it's better than it was. But people don't understand that even that was fought for. People don't understand that it was movement.
Or that 100 years ago, women, you know, endured up to force feeding in prison in order to fight for the vote. It's true.
Yeah, it's just that it really just comes down to people having a short memory. People want to believe that the time for protesting and all that is over. You know, it's like the whole idea of like liberal Democrats who think that the amount of protesting that needs to be done has already been done, and we should just be satisfied with what we have. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, it's not satisfactory. I mean, even when it was good, you know, there were people, you know, like I was saying before, you know, it took communists and the old CIO and, you know, different organizations to really force FDR to make the move he did on the New Deal. And, you know, even that was something that corporations fought against, because they didn't want to pay the taxes. They didn't want to pay people a living wage to work. I mean, this country was built on cheap labor. I mean, if they couldn't get the enslaved Africans to stay and work, they went and they went and destabilized whole countries from Mexico down south to be able to create a permanent influx of labor that they could both demonize and utilize.
Indeed. And of course, as we know, the corporations ended up pretty much winning out fairly completely out of that, with the historic compromise with labor that basically defanged much of the labor movement in terms of not being able to do wildcat strikes, and basically narrowing their focus very, very narrowly to wages and not to actual control over the workplace, allowing corporations massive amounts of political power, increasing anyway. So yeah, it's a massive situation that we're up against, that the Democrats are retrenching themselves against, despite you know, the squad, and despite really, really courageous, amazing, mostly people of color in their ranks who are breaking ranks, and that's who we have to support. I mean, I'll just say, since I put out the idea, I'm one of those who's sort of been swayed to the hold your nose and vote for Biden and continue to put the pressure on, but I'm always interested in any other perspectives. We have another caller online. You want any final thoughts?
You know, just in terms of what happened, you know, with that transgender woman, I just, you know, I want people to understand that, you know, you need to pick up a book and realize that this is not a new tactic. You know, the only difference is that we're living in a time where we have more access to information of things happening. I mean, whole black communities were brought down simply on accusations of something bad happening to somebody else. You know, Tulsa, for example, you know, the whole city was torn down just because of an insinuation of rape by a black person. A whole community, whole wealth, whole everything torn down, not even a conviction. So understand that this is a tactic. They want you to not have any empathy for the side that's really fighting for true freedom. And the last thing I'll say too is just, you know, we don't hold your nose and vote. What I would say is, be very specific about why you're voting. You know, like I told somebody else, you know, we're at the late stage of capitalism where we're basically trying to decide which final boss we want to go against in the last round. You know, and I'm not going to shame anybody for not voting for Biden or Harris. But the truth is that whether or not you vote, the protests have to continue, because true change has only come from the bottom up, not from the top down.
Right on. Always good to hear your perspective, James. And I've got another regular caller, Robbie, on deck here. So let's just go right to Robbie.
Good
go
morning.
Ahead. You're on the air.
Loved the conversation. Always love it. I was gonna bring up. I can't bring myself to vote for Biden and Harris. It's just you know, one of the things with Colin Powell being there and speaking. Joe Biden was one of the main Democrats pushing for the Iraq War in 1998. He like testified in front of Congress and said the only way we're gonna, you know, be able to deal with Iraq is by invasion. And sure enough, you know, he was the main culprit on that side getting it passed. So I just think the hypocrisy of the Democrats is very blatant. And the idea that, you know, oh, Harris said that she's gonna give land back, or you know, you can hear what they say on stage, which sounds really nice and like a lot better than Donald Trump. But then you look at what they do, and it's, you know, I don't want to say it's the same as Donald Trump, because obviously there's a lot of stuff that, you know, he's doing. But when it comes time to the vote, I think what I stress is education about voting, because I know that I'm in a state which is going to be giving all the electoral colleges to whatever, you know, a nominee gets the most popular vote. Whoever wins the most popular vote, I believe Oregon's a part of the Western PAC awarding their electoral college. So I really think we need to start holding the Democratic Party accountable, because I've done research into it. The Democratic Party came from the Democratic Republicans centuries ago, I guess. And eventually that one party then split and became the Whig Party, which eventually became the Democratic Party, and then the Republican Democrats became the Republicans. And so what I find extremely interesting is that in American politics, we've gotten so far shifted right, and that's because these two political parties own our politics. And I would like to describe, you know how I like conspiracy theories a little bit, right?
I've gotten that impression.
the good ones, not the crazy, you know, right wing ones. But
yeah.
I believe, and it's funny because it's coming to fruition now. People don't understand what these terms mean. We've been given a two dimensional system of left and right, and that I believe was used for control, because everybody knows that the four dimensional, you know, political spectrum is a much more accurate representation of, you know, politics. But in America, because we have Democrats and Republicans, we've been simplified to a two-dimensional line of left and right. Now, when I was growing up, it was extremely confusing, because I was very interested in politics. But I looking at the left and the right, it made no sense to me where anarchism fit on it, because anarchy, or no government, I guess, isn't on the left, which was considered, you know, authoritarian or socialism, you know, total government. And then on the far right, you have fascism and nationalism, which is also total government. So,
well, socialism, I don't think you can totally, I mean, there's various, you know, actually anarchism was considered, it grew out of the socialist sort of movement. It was a libertarian socialism. There's always been different tendencies or wings of socialism. There's, you know, there's bottom-up democratic socialism, and then there's, you know, total party control, top-down, elite-run, managerial-run state socialism, which is what we've gotten in a lot of places like Soviet Union and China. But it's not the only model. I think to say there's this stark sharp distinction between quote anarchism and quote socialism, I think, is a mistake. But go on.
Well, no, that's you basically brought up my point that I'm trying to make, which is that we're stuck in a mindset. You're obviously well educated on the topics of socialism and communism. Communism means no government. in its true form, right? But communist government,
right, the supposed withering away of the state, yeah, which always gets delayed because of some national security or some, you know, production necessity or something, but yeah.
Right. So I all I see is that the thing is we have, you know, low information voters or even Americans that are just kind of stupid. Sorry, but look at how many people voted for Trump but when you have a mindset that's tainted with this two-dimensional thing, that's why we're hearing this stuff of, like, you know, it's how they were able to brand socialism as this bad word. Because the USPS is socialism. You know what I mean? Like, that's, you can't have, the thing about socialism, and I kind of define it like this. I'd like to hear what you think about this. But I see that a government it's a balance. Socialism and capitalism is a balance. If you have a nation that practices nothing but socialism, that's a communist nation. And if you have a capitalist nation, which practices nothing but capitalism and privatizes everything and does no socialism, that's a fascist nation, because you have corporations now controlling the state, or religion at that point. But so that's how, you know, the left and the right is. But the problem that I see is that we're stuck in this two-dimensional thing because the Democratic and the Republican Party keeps us in that form of what you described as, you know, we're calling socialism as total government. You know, people are like, oh, that's a socialist, and they throw it as if it's an all or nothing thing. But in reality, it's a balance, and I think it's just people who don't understand these terms and the political spectrum. And I think,
well, you're getting into a big can of worms there. I'm not sure I would agree about a balance between capitalism and socialism. I mean, capitalism is an economic system. I guess socialism is too. Socialism is supposedly the, you know, in a very, very reductionist sense, socialism is the public ownership of the means of production, whereas capitalism is the private ownership of the means of production. But yeah, this is too big a subject to get into. I think capitalism is basically a form of, you know, where you have the ability of, you know, where you have certain mechanisms like profit, interest, rent, which did not exist before historically, that only came into existence because of the, you know, the invention of private property, where, you know, individuals, strong individuals, can own land, and then they can own the ability to do what they want with that land, and then they can control other people by by having military, by having control over managerial class. Yeah, I think capitalism is a problematic move historically. So anyway,
capitalism leads to fascism, because that's how these outside interests gain power. They gain power through the attainment of wealth, which is, you know, that's
right.
What
well,
I see.
Let me finish the thought. I just realized what I want to say. So the problem is that. The real problem is really difficult to talk about, which is that I think there's a normative kind of society, which is basically a small group where face-to-face communities, where people, there's private ownership in the sense that, yeah, people make tools and they have tools, or they make their house and that's their house and is recognized by other people, and the other people don't come in and just take it away because that's what they use. But it's more like that's what they use. But the social, it's all in the social relationships, that people have a very different kind of social relationship, in that they don't have, there aren't the forms I'm starting to lose myself, but I think the problem is in the kind of social relationships that we have, and the kind of the size and scale of the society. I think anytime you get to the kind of large scale, centrally organized societies, it's automatically going to create problems. You're automatically going to have these power imbalances. So, you know, how do we get away from that? That's a big question. But, well, let me give you a response. But we have Norm hopefully still waiting on the line to talk also.
I'll just wrap it up with this, which is what I think we need to start going to a third party to break this cycle. I think it's a trap. I think the two-dimensional left and right, there's total government on both sides, and anarchism doesn't fit on there. I think that should be something that we should start recognizing and start trying to pull together a third party.
Fair enough. On that note, I thank you. Always good to hear from you, Robbie. Yeah, third-party politics, that's another. My personal feeling is that we're running really fast out of time in terms of the actual physical reality of things. The rate that the Arctic is speeding up is so far beyond what we thought even 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, that the danger of even more bigger tipping points than are already being triggered happening in a really short period of time is really extreme at this point. And I don't know exactly what is going to stem the tide, if anything. But we got Norm on the line. Are you still there, Norm?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Paul.
Go ahead.
Okay. I guess I should begin with the reasons why I am no longer participating in the activities in what I call the war zone downtown. I am a son, and I am the son of a couple of people who I choose out of my real love for them to not engage them in any debate regarding the president occupant of the White House. I'm also a father, and a brother, and although they completely agree with me, they are worried about me going down there, and I personally am not going to face down a row of stormtroopers, simply to get shot and to get gassed. And because of that, I've been hanging around the edges of this action, which I'm going to say I agree with, and the fights, and the violence that's taking place around the peripheries, between rednecks and teenagers, is simply campaign ads for the president. And I also have to admit that I'm bleeping scared. I don't want to get shot with a quote less lethal projectile, and I don't want to get tear gassed because I'm a person in my mid-60s,
but you say you support those who are willing to put themselves in that position, though.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I support them. But another thing is about, it's too darned easy to infiltrate this action. Lots of people, totally masked up, and a lot of people, it's even hard to tell whether they're male or female, and I do not trust very many individuals at all in this action.
Well, I'm not sure what not being able to tell whether they're male or female has to do with anything, but go ahead.
There are women with boyish figures, and
right,
there
but
are
I don't understand the importance
with,
of that.
With girlish figures, and that's a side issue, and I'm just scared,
okay.
And the
well,
people that love me are scared, and I'm gonna honor that. because my daughter doesn't want to bleep and bury me.
Fair enough.
I don't blame her at all.
Okay. Right on. Well, that's your personal decision, Norm, and certainly we all respect that. And I think the question of the easiness to infiltrate is an interesting question that might be worth exploring. The extent to which there is infiltration, the whole issue of, you know, as I said, sort of a group responsibility for individual actions. A lot of people deny that that exists. I personally think there should be the possibility of group decision, although I realize in the heat of battle, so to speak, things happen really quickly and it's, you know, sometimes almost impossible. But I, you know, the problem is we don't have, you know, in certain situations you actually have kind of a regular cadre, so to speak, you know, almost military-like formations, revolutionary formations, where people are trained together and they know each other and they build up bonds of trust. In these more spontaneous situations, it's a very different kind of situation. And you know, I think the thing about the Antifa with the Patriot Prayer is I think there was building up a certain sort of level of knowing each other and sort of acting together. I don't know to what extent, but again, it gets back to these mass society type situations where you know it's really difficult to form revolutionary organizations because if you're going against the state, you're up against massive repression and infiltration by agents of the state. So it's a very, you know, I think that's one thing that isn't talked about enough, that the difficulty of organizing more radical anti-authoritarian, anti-state, anti-fascist actions in the kind of society we live in are very, very difficult. You know, you have some groups like the John Brown Gun Club, very small groups that are armed and that are, you know, engaged in that kind of activity, but they're small. When you get into these large, fluid, chaotic protest situations, but anyway, I've gone off too long. I'll give you a chance to respond, and then we've got Jeremy on the line.
I respect the diversity of tactics, and thank you for hearing me out, Paul.
Right on. Thanks, Norm. The diversity of tactics. I guess I, as talk show host, I put myself in the position of being able to respond to everything. I always had a little bit of a difficulty with the diversity of tactics. It just seems too simplistic to me. I have a phrase, the invisible hand of the movement, which somehow makes everything all work out, all the diversity of tactics all work out. I think there's certain tactics. I think it also sort of, in some ways, forestalls actual more serious thinking and coming to grips with what are the actual tactics that we need to use. I mean, I'm kind of a sucker for the old, you know, I really like in the Occupy where people really tried to come to some kind of, you know, a people's assembly and really make collective decisions, although incredibly difficult to do. And again, it gets back to the idea of when you're in the heat of battle, you know, who is it that's leading the battle? You know, because you can't have, you know, we don't have generals, corporals, lieutenants like, you know, like a Revolutionary Army might have. You know, there's sort of the current tenor of organizing is against hierarchical centralized leadership. But, you know, we don't have, you know, the kind of where everybody really knows each other really well and they've done so much together that they sort of just move together, you know, just seamlessly as a unit, like I've seen happen in actual anarchist circles, more sort of like, you know, organized activities, not necessarily protests. But yeah, these are difficult questions, but let's hear what Jeremy has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, going back a couple of callers, this is I think a very useful slogan / cliche from I guess before the Berlin Wall, when there was a free world and the communist world. Anyway, the free world isn't free and the communist world isn't communist. So that's And I think that's still sort of true. You know, those who claim or aspire to socialism, especially when they hold state power, are nothing, don't represent any vision of freedom that I can relate to. You know, they're busy murdering their opponents and hence solidifying their power. That's why I'm an anarchist. I liked what you just said. I haven't had those wonderful anarchic experiences where people were, I think your age, but perhaps I haven't had, you know, as much positive experience as you have. And I'd like you to elaborate on that. The one thing I wanted to say about Antifa, I'm glad they were there. I suppose I support the diversity of their tactics. I think it's, you know, Nazis of real and or growing, you know, incipient power need to be confronted. However, the fact that I couldn't even get these, you know, 19-year-olds of various ages, what sort of, you know, sensitive, mutually caring society we're going to have where people can't even show basic courtesy to each other, you know, at a demonstration. Found it, you know, wildly obnoxious. And
well, we gotta let you go, and we got Sherry on the line. But thank you for sharing that, Jeremy. Appreciate it. I don't know about your personal experiences, individual experience with people. It's kind of hard for anybody to really get at. But let's. I do want to address your question about my experiences because I think they're actually kind of informative and interesting. But let's hear what Sherry has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. I want to respond to the general concept of the voting thing, and I agree with pretty much everything that other guy was talking about socialism and a couple people about third parties, and the Democratic Party is rotten to the core. And I am voting for Biden this year because I can't stand him. He was my last choice. I was so disappointed and so at his winning the nomination. It's all rigged. I don't even think he won. It's all other people, some elites or whatever, controlling the DNC. I hate the DNC. But I am voting for Biden because I just don't see how anyone can see we have any other option right now. As bad as Biden is, Trump is just awful. I mean, he is taking our country down. We're literally hanging, our democracy is hanging by a thread. And I just don't see, this will be the first time I'm voting for a Democrat in 30 years. Vote for Obama. Other than Obama, I haven't voted. I haven't been a member of the Democratic Party in over 30 years. I was a member of the Green Party of Alaska.
Right.
And then I've been a member of the Working Families Party of Oregon for the last 25 years. And I strongly believe in third parties. But this isn't the time to do that. And I've heard other people say that years ago. I did not vote for Hillary Clinton. Don't like her. I don't respect, I don't trust the Democratic establishment, the entrenched Democrats at all. But and even with all that, if Trump wins another term, we are all completely screwed. And I feel like I share so many views with these other callers, and yet in the end they're not going to vote. And it's like, are you kidding?
Well, I think only one person may have said they weren't going to vote, but
not going to vote for Biden. It's like, this isn't the time to do that. You vote for Biden, and I'm not even saying a hold my nose or not or whatever. I can't stand Biden, but I can't stand Trump even more.
Right. Well,
the 45 administration want to start drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I spent the summer in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And spent years doing what I could to protect it. I'm an organic farmer. I feel like I share a lot of values with all these people, and I totally get their disappointment and dislike and hatred, whatever you want to call it, disdain for the Democratic Party and the DNC. And now I see, I went online, and there's this whole new movement called Democratic Exits. Yeah, I think it's outrageous that they had Republicans at their convention and gave AOC 60 seconds. Everything about it just stinks. But look at the only other option is Trump. In fact, I heard, you know, we all know he lost by 3 million votes 4 years ago, and he still won because of the Electoral College. I've heard it's still been so rigged because the voting rights have been so taken away that he could still lose by 5 million votes, and he could still win the Electoral College.
Right.
I don't know
if
that's
true.
That's something I read. But I feel like everybody who cares about the future of this country and democracy, and if there's going to be any chance for climate change mitigation, we have to get Trump out of office. So he's doing everything fast and furious as he possibly can. He didn't care. You know, this administration doesn't care about the environment. And
no, let me just say one thing, which is that I basically agree with what you're saying. And I my disagreement with the way this debate or conversation is carried out is I don't, you know, I've talked about reform versus revolution on the show. But in this case, I don't see a particular vote like tainting anyone morally or like being seriously. I mean, maybe people might feel that way, but I don't feel that way, and I don't see it as such a dramatic thing like a going back on one's principles. I think you can vote, and especially if you're engaged in more direct and, you know, kind of organizing and actions and such. I just don't see it as an either or thing,
right?
I guess. So yeah,
neither reform or revolution. We need both. We need to vote against Trump, and we need to have a revolution in our voting rights and our agricultural systems and our racial justice. We do need a revolution, but we're going to all be who knows what's going to happen under the Trump administration.
This is true.
They have proven to be complete.
We only have about 5 minutes left, and I got another caller, so I totally support what you're saying, Sherry, and thank you for calling, and thank you everybody else for calling. 503-231-8187. There may be time for someone after Morris. Let's hear what you have to say. Go ahead, Morris.
It's Boris, actually, but
Boris,
I
hey.
Want to continue the conversation of infiltrators and provocateurs. I've been out in the streets myself for years. I've been arrested. And I went down to what's going on now to observe for myself what was actually taking place. I'd seen a lot of videos, but I thought, I want to see it with my own eyes. And I am convinced that there is a provocateur element in this, and I wish it wasn't the end of your program, because I would really like to hear someone call in that is, you know, doing property destruction, which in and of itself I don't have anything against, but I see no point in continuing to, you know, throw rocks at cops, light fires night after night. You know, if there's a point to it, I'd like to know, because when I was down there witnessing it myself, it was an obvious attempt to bring, you know, the stormtroopers out from behind the doors by initiating, you know, provocateur acts, certainly throwing industrial-grade firecrackers, or not firecrackers, but fireworks in the midst of cops is not going to it's not going to do anything but aggravate them. So I don't get it.
Well, I think people see themselves as in. I think there's a, I guess what philosophers might call. I think it's possibly what philosophers might call a logical, a category mistake or something. I'm being kind of facetious, but I think some people really do see themselves as in the war, a war, the war. Whereas I don't think that's actually what it is. This is a. These are in some sense, I mean, they're symbolic actions. They're of course real actions, but I think when you're in a, I guess what I'm trying to say is when you're in an actual war, it's different. You're actually, you know, you're trying to actually, you know, kill, cripple, you know, whatever, the opponent. And so they're almost proxies, I see. They're almost proxies for what people really want to be in a war. I mean, I'm talking about a certain element, I think. They really want to be in a war, but they really can't be in a war. So the next best thing is to do that. That's my sort of best characterization of assuming people aren't actually provocateurs. Because I agree with you. I think that the nature of sort of spectacular direct action or protest, the nature of it is it needs to evolve and constantly change. And when it doesn't, and people just do the same thing over and over again, it kind of gets bogged down. I don't know. That's an interesting conversation. Again, we can't really have at the end of the hour. I'll give you one last...
My final point is this. The video footage of this stuff serves the fascist agenda perfectly, and I don't know why people don't wake up to that. Be creative. Do different things. Don't just keep aggravating the cops and destroying property, because I don't see where it does anything but push the Trump agenda. He's already got a big law and order thing going for the Republican convention, so
okay.
Pretty obvious to me.
That's a point of view that I've heard expressed widely that deserves a fuller conversation. But let's give Elliot 30 seconds, squeeze him in. Go ahead, Elliot.
Very, very, very quickly, I think people should read Tightrope by Nick Kristof regarding white deaths of despair in rural Oregon. If the Portland left could truly unify into a supermajority with the so-called deplorables, it would be an unstoppable supermajority for
reform. Well, there's an interesting thing to throw out at the very end of the show. Good Lord. Well, okay, we'll just keep that there dangling, tantalizing. Okay, well, thank you for that. Interesting. Are you still there? Okay, actually, I probably should have let you expand on that a little more, Elliot. Sorry about that. It just sort of took me aback. But no, I've heard that expressed in various ways. Organize, and the Rural Organizing Project is actually working in rural areas of Oregon, and whether or not they're actually forging revolutionary bonds with the people you're talking about, the so-called deplorables. Again, that's such a huge conversation. We can't really get into it. I actually, for some reason, thought we were out of time, but actually we actually have a few more minutes. So here I am, myself dangling at the end of the show. Apologies to Elliot. I for some reason, I thought we were off at 8:55, but we actually have a few more minutes. So anyway, let me just still respond to Jeremy, because I think it is interesting. And my experiences with anarchist organizing, I don't know, we had these amazing, what we called resistere, which is r/esistere, which is like the words resist and exist together, which is a concept that a lot of people have taken up. We had these amazing events with up to a couple hundred people or more over the course of a few days, where we basically organized as we went. Sometimes it was stationary. Sometimes we did a hike in large group of people, and we had a support crew with a truck that took all the kitchen. But yeah, there was no real set roles. Everybody just, and this is in a cultural context where people, a lot of people knew each other, had done a lot of stuff together already. We also had a lot of new people. A lot of the new people had experience anarchist organizing, and I think it's really a natural way to be. Actually, it's very controversial. I know. I think we're really actually made to sort of observe what's happening, and join and learn as we go, and join in as we feel able. And when we're empowered to do that in such situations like these relatively large group. Fluid situations, people just naturally want to help. I think you see that, in the protests downtown with a lot of the people providing food, the people providing, legal observers. There's a lot of different roles that happen, and a lot of nonviolent campaigns, a lot of direct action, not necessarily nonviolent, but direct action campaigns that I've been involved in or seen, there's always various roles that, you know, people are trained for, but people can sort of pick up on as you go along. And the problem is where you have people who maybe have their own agendas or have their own anger issues or whatever, and you don't really have kind of a real cohesive situation or, you know, really strong group principles or agreements, then it does create difficulty because, you know, in chaotic situations people can do. But yeah, I've seen anarchist situations work really, really, really well, where people are just acting coherently and cohesively in a non-hierarchical fluid way. And I think those are really powerful experiences. I think those are the kind of experiences that prepare us for really difficult situations. We need to, you know, we need to create more of those situations. We need to. So I think, you know, to some extent that is what happens in the protests that have been going on. I think people sort of find their roles. I think the problems I've been pointing out, you know, I'm a distant observer myself, so I'm not sure what I even have to say very fruitful about them. But anyway, those are my last words for today. I hope you found this interesting. I want to thank all our callers for calling in. I want to apologize to any caller who tried to get in and wasn't able to, or maybe didn't get as much time as they wanted. Anyway, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland. Be talking with you next week. Stay tuned for more great programming. Thank you, Sonia, for board hopping today. Bye-bye, everybody.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.